Hello there and welcome. Today is Tuesday, October the 4th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the latest presidential campaign controversy, Donald Trump's taxes.
I have a fiduciary responsibility to pay no more tax than is legally required, like anybody else.
The vice presidential candidates will have their only face-off Tuesday night. The U.S. suspends talks with Russia over Syria. Also ahead, a Texas teen is making it big in the world of blues music. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, Hillary Clinton is trying to capitalize on news that Donald Trump may have paid no federal taxes for years. In Ohio on Monday, at a campaign event, she pushed back on Trump's argument that he brilliantly used tax laws to his advantage.
Then you all know that in the debate, he said it was smart to avoid paying taxes. Yesterday, his campaign was bragging it makes him a genius. Here's my question. What kind of genius loses $1 billion in a single year?
And at a campaign rally in Colorado, Trump cast himself as a savvy businessman, telling supporters he intends to use his tax law expertise to fix the system.
I have often said on the campaign trail that I have a fiduciary responsibility to pay no more tax than is legally required, like anybody else. Or, put another way, to pay as little tax as legally possible.
Joining me now to understand this a little better, Ed McCaffrey, professor of law, economics, and political science at the University of Southern California. Thank you for being here. What do you make of all of these revelations?
What we know is that there's essentially $1 billion, you know, $916 million in 1995, worth more than $1 billion today. So there's $1 billion tax loss. We do not know. Some of Trump's surrogates have been assuming that Trump himself invested the $1 billion, lost the $1 billion, and therefore it's fair that he should be able to deduct it. But there's no evidence that Trump came out of his own pocket with the $1 billion. He generally does not put much of his own money into his activities. He has not put much of his own money into his own presidential campaign. He's the self-described king of debt. So there's plenty of reason to believe that these very large tax losses did not come from Trump's own money, which raises the question of where did they come from? If they didn't come from his own money, these would be the products of some sophisticated financial and tax planning. There was a lot of aggressive tax planning in the 1980s and 1990s by wealthy individuals to generate tax losses well beyond their economic out-of-pocket, in which case Donald Trump is getting tax breaks from other people's money to continue to shelter his earnings from paying any federal income tax. And I think there are a lot of questions about the ethics of that, possibly about the legality of that, but we need to know the details.
How were they able to extract the information that they did from just that tax return about possibly not paying taxes for 18 years?
Good question. Parts of that are technical. But so someone sends a business reporter at the New York Times just 3 pages of state tax returns. So they're very incomplete, just the front page. Now, whoever sent that knows that what would get the biggest attention was a $916 million tax loss. So on a partial state return, we can see an eye-poppingly big number that raises lots of questions. So there's a line item that says this is your loss. That kind of loss on that line item means that it can be an operating loss. It is an operating loss, and you can carry it back. He can go 3 years before 1995, amend his returns, and use some of those losses to wipe out the taxes he did pay in 1992, 1993, 1994, leading to a refund. And then whatever's left of that $916 million, which is a huge number, of course, he can keep using it for up to 15 more years by taking a piece of it to wipe out whatever income he happens to have in 1996, 1997. These 1995 returns showed very little income, by the way. They just showed this huge loss. But if he, in fact, had turned around his financial affairs, if he made $50 million a year for the next 15 years after 1995, mm-hmm. he would pay no federal tax. It's been described as a get-out-of-jail-free card. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like a coupon that covers any income that may come. So from that very big number, where it was on that form, that's what follows. What we can figure out, because we only have those three one-page forms, is where the heck did that $916 million come from? That's a big question, and there are lots of possible answers, and the Trump surrogates are just assuming the best.
His surrogates are calling him a genius.
I just heard his campaign manager, Kellyanne Conway, her line is, he's a good guy who invested in the community. He's the comeback kid. He put $1 billion out there, and she's saying it was to help New York. The business deal went bad, and he lost $1 billion. My point is there's no evidence that he's ever put that kind of money into anything. That's not the story he tells about himself. He doesn't tell a story of spectacular losses that were a learning lesson, and he came back. He says he made money on everything he's done. He says he made money in Atlantic City. Well, if that's true, and he has tax losses, that meant that he did something sophisticated and aggressive. It doesn't make him personally a genius. It means that he hired people who knew that his utility function, his preference, was to pay no tax. So he hired aggressive accountants and lawyers, and they did something to make him pay no tax, and there's no evidence that he understands what they did. And we, the public, can't figure out what he did because we only have those three pages of his tax form.
Ed McCaffrey, professor of law, economics, and political science at the University of Southern California. Turning now to Tuesday night's one and only vice presidential debate. Joining me for that, from Farmville, Virginia, VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson, where the debate will be held.
Really, the only thing out in this town are two colleges, one of which, Longwood University, is actually hosting the debate. Otherwise, the rest of the town is very small, very rural. It's a very conservative place. I see a lot of Trump-Pence signs along the roadsides. This is very much Trump territory. This is playing to his strengths in terms of white, rural, conservative voters. And they're all very excited. They have been telling me all week about how exciting it is to have the vice presidential candidate, Mike Pence, coming into town.
What's the format for this debate?
Well, it's very similar to the first presidential debate that we saw a couple of days ago, which was a 90-minute program divided into nine blocks covering a whole range of topics. And believe me, Mike Pence and Tim Kaine are very much detail-oriented policy guys who have been prepping intensively for this debate. One report said that Mike Pence had been preparing for this one debate ever since he was nominated as vice president.
Wow. So it should be quite different than the last debate we saw.
Just a little bit. These guys are the policy guys, that's for sure.
What's at stake for the vice presidential candidates, or does it even really matter?
That's always the question with a vice presidential debate. You know, usually people don't vote based on that second name on the ticket. Vice president can only really hurt you. And in the case of these two candidates, Mike Pence and Tim Kaine, they're definitely the lower key members of those tickets. They're kind of overshadowed by the big, strong personalities of Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. So it's unlikely that unless there's some massive flub or gaffe that one of them says, this debate really won't make an impact. Now, that said, there have been past vice presidential debates with very memorable lines from Sarah Palin or Dan Quayle, and those will be replayed over and over again in the future.
But ultimately, vice presidential debates
rarely make an impact on the polls.
Catherine, this is coming right after a pretty rough week for Donald Trump. a number of things plaguing him now that he's on the defensive over, including revelations that he may not have paid taxes for years, federal taxes.
Absolutely. You know, Mike Pence has been preparing for this debate for a long time, but he couldn't have prepared for this moment. He will almost certainly have to answer some questions about that issue. And it really remains to be seen how he'll be able to address it, because in the last debate, Donald Trump said quite openly that he was smart to avoid paying federal taxes. And ultimately, with a lot of Trump supporters and many of the people that I've spoken to here in Farmville this past week, this really doesn't matter to them. They see this as an attack from mainstream media and liberals and Democrats as a way of bringing Trump down in the weeks leading up to Election Day. It's really a matter of what it will mean for undecided voters.
All right. Thanks so much, Catherine Gibson. We'll be checking back with you tomorrow after the debate. Let's turn now to what's been trending on social media today with G. Abby Lee. Hi, G. What's happening?
Hi, Lori. Let's start with an interesting turn of events from two media outlets. Cable TV station CNN is going to have a team of new employees, and that's because it hired the entire investigative political research department from online publication BuzzFeed. The team is called K-File, and it's led by longtime BuzzFeed reporter Andrew Kaczynski. Naturally, he tweeted about it. He's on Twitter at KFile and retweeted a breaking news about the change from a media reporter. He captioned it, "Some personal news." He also tweeted, "Going to miss my BuzzFeed family and so grateful for the mentorship and opportunity given to me by BuzzFeed Ben at Catherine Miller." So the first person is the company's editor-in-chief and the second is its political editor.
Wow, that's some pretty big news. What are people saying about the change online?
Some people are saying, can you imagine at BuzzFeed Andrew, that's K-File's old handle, fact-checking Trump's former campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski, live on CNN while seated next to him in the studio. Media insiders are tweeting that it's a huge loss for BuzzFeed, but a huge get for CNN.
All right. Well, American celebrity Kim Kardashian trending on social media today. What happened?
So she was trending actually quite big with more than 390,000 people talking about her. She was reportedly held up at gunpoint at a hotel in Paris, and French police have confirmed that she was tied up and that several millions worth of jewelry was taken. It looks like she is unharmed and is no longer in France. Most of the reactions on Twitter are jokes about her, which comedian James Corden pointed out in his tweet. He tweeted, "People making jokes about Kim Kardashian tonight would do well to remember that she is a mother, a daughter, a wife, a friend. Be nice or be quiet." He has more than 100,000 followers on Twitter, so he has quite a reach on social media. Lori?
All right. Thanks so much, G. You can follow her at G. Abby Lee. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. A U.S. journalist sues Iran and says he was tortured. New York orders a halt to the Trump Foundation fundraising. Haiti, Jamaica, and Cuba call for evacuations as Hurricane Matthew approaches. And Prince's death inquiry focuses now on the source of his fatal overdose. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The United States on Monday suspended serious ceasefire talks, citing continued military attacks on civilians in the northern city of Aleppo, and said Russia has not lived up to terms related to humanitarian aid deliveries. A Syrian monitoring group says more than 400 civilians, including 72 children, have been killed in and around the city since the ceasefire collapsed 2 weeks ago. Activists say warplanes have once again targeted one of the largest trauma and emergency hospitals in Aleppo. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon says he's deeply alarmed by what's happening.
We are out of words to express our outrage at the carnage, especially in Aleppo. The brutality is unrelenting.
Well, joining me now, Jamil Jaffer, adjunct professor of Homeland and National Security Law at the George Mason University School of Law. Jamil, U.S. relations with Russia also deteriorating.
Our effort to work with the Russians, always sort of problematic from the jump, has appeared to have gotten worse. I mean, the Russians have very successfully been able to decimate the moderate opposition that we support and then turn to us and blame us for not working hard enough against the al-Qaeda affiliate there in the region, what used to be called the Nusra Front, which, of course, none of which is true. The Russians, you know, now trying to say the reason that they're not doing what they said they were going to do because we said we weren't going to do what we were going to do. None of that's accurate, but it's not surprising given the Russians' own goals in the region.
They also pretty much threatened the U.S. not to try to go after government forces, that it would warning it would create a spiral effect and complete chaos in the Middle East.
You know, our stated policy is a Syria without an Assad government, as well as the removal of areas of control from ISIS control. We've not been successful in either of those efforts, unfortunately. We have made some tactical gains against ISIS. They've gained some of those territories back. With respect to Syrian government, however, and they're actually now continuing to be more successful with the support of the Russians that you see in Aleppo. They've really turned the situation there in Aleppo. They had a success in Palmyra a while back. Some of those successes are good for us. Syrian government success against ISIS helps us in the fight against ISIS, but it doesn't help the humanitarian situation, nor does it help our apparent longer-term goal of a Syria without an Assad government.
Ban Ki-moon recently said, you know, these are crimes against humanity. These are war crimes. You know, when you start bombing hospitals, how is Russia allowed to break international war crime law and not be held accountable?
The Assad regime has been using chemical weapons for quite a while. So the attacks against hospitals, the attacks against the aid convoy in September, you know, there have been claims about, oh, these were mistakes and there were errors. But, you know, a single mistake is understandable. A number of them in a row seems like a plan, just like Russia's claims that they didn't intentionally hit the moderate rebels that we were supporting after having agreed not to do so. You know, but again, this is just another aspect of a larger flaunting of international law by Russia and by its client state, the Syrian regime. You know, as I was saying earlier, the Syrians have used chemical weapons. They violated our red line. We did nothing about it. They allegedly, in our deal with Russia, handed over all their chemical weapons. And yet, you know, day after day, we see chlorine attacks against Syrian civilians. I mean, we've even seen some sarin and mustard gas attacks. And so these are very troubling signs. And the Russians are not doing the part in the bargain that we agreed to with back a couple few years back, and certainly not doing their part in the effort against ISIS and the al-Qaeda affiliate on the former al-Nusra Front.
Why is Russia so aligned with Syria?
The Russians have long had a military presence in the region in Syria at Tartus, the naval base there. And that has long been sort of Russia's toehold in the Middle East. You know, back in the 80s, Russia had client relations with other Middle Eastern states and sold weapons to those states, but, you know, including at one time Egypt. And over time, it lost that influence as it decayed in power. But it always maintained that relationship with Syria. And Assad has always had a close relationship with the Russians. And so the Russians didn't get involved in a big way until after we opened the door to them getting involved with our deal with them on the chemical weapons, when we didn't enforce our red line. And ever since then, they've been more and more involved. And they've become more aggressive in other parts of the world, too. You know, Ukraine and their actions there, I think, are a direct result of their perception that the U.S. is a paper tiger, that we won't stand up and enforce our rules when we say we're going to.
Well, it sure has. Jamil Jaffer, professor of Homeland and National Security Law at George Mason University in Washington. Well, members of the world's largest conservation treaty, CITES, on Monday struck down proposals to allow legal sales of some elephant ivory and rhino horn. Both sides of the argument, though, tried to paint this as a clear-cut issue, but as experts at this massive conference explained, it's complicated. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
The deliberations were long, debate was impassioned, and votes were decisive. On Monday, members of the Convention on Illegal Trade and Endangered Species of Wild Fauna and Flora killed proposals to legalize trade in elephant ivory and rhino horn. It was the key issue at this year's conference in Johannesburg. Nations with the world's largest elephant and rhino populations, among them Zimbabwe and Swaziland, argued that legal trade in these banned animal products will bring much-needed funds for conservation. The most visible opponents of this idea appealed to the heart, and as the conference began last week, hundreds of campaigners marched against the proposals, passionately calling for protection for these iconic, beloved creatures. Elephant and rhino expert Tom Milliken says love has little to do with this issue. Money matters, too. He says his organization, Traffic, sides with the majority in its decision to not allow legal sales for now.
But we are entirely sympathetic to the motivation that Swaziland has to leverage finance. And this is the rub here, that if the global community is expecting that there will be rhinos in Africa, elephants in Africa, in perpetuity, who is going to pay for that to happen? Because the finance is just not available. And the more we foreclose on the avenues of realizing finance that Africans themselves can do, sustainable utilization of resources, trade, sport hunting, these sorts of things, and we're not replacing it with other tools in a toolbox, these are countries that are cash-strapped.
The populations of these animals are equally vulnerable. The International Union for Conservation of Nature revealed that the African elephant population has dropped by about 111,000 in the last decade, the worst decline in a quarter century. Earlier this year, the IUCN reported that rhino poaching has increased for the sixth consecutive year. Jan Creamer, president of Animal Defenders International, says her group unequivocally supports banning all trade in ivory and rhino. Her argument appeals to emotion and, she says, human decency.
Human beings have to find a way to live alongside the other species that share our planet and to respect and preserve them and do the best we can to give them space to live. We don't agree with exploitation of animals for their body parts. The stories that we've heard from the people like the rangers here at this conference are heartbreaking. These animals are being driven to extinction.
The other side is equally passionate. Tanya Jacobson is a surprising advocate in favor of rhino horn sales. For starters, she's a vegetarian for ethical reasons. She works with the South Africa-based Rhino Alive campaign, which, as its name indicates, wants to harvest rhino horn without killing the animals.
Our feeling is that rhino horn is a sustainable product. It can be removed from a rhino humanely without causing any harm at all to rhinos. And based on this and based on the fact that rhino horn regrows at a rate of about 1 to 2 kilograms per year, we strongly feel that instead of having a situation where we're facing huge poaching dilemmas, that there is a sustainable conservation-based solution to the crisis.
Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
This is VOA's International Edition.
Join us for VOA's coverage of the most important U.S. political event of the year. Americans will decide who their next president will be. We'll have all the context, commentary, and analysis with our coverage of the U.S. presidential election. Right here on VOA.
I'm Victor Beatty. Since 1942, the Voice of America has been a consistently reliable and authoritative source of news. Today, VOA remains committed to providing an accurate, objective, and comprehensive news product at the top of every hour, every day. We can be heard on your local affiliate or streamed on the web at voanews.com.
This is VOA's International Edition. Drawing on the blues music roots of her home in East Texas, as well as the style of the late Texas blues rocker Stevie Ray Vaughan, 17-year-old Allie Venable is gaining attention across the U.S. As VOA's Greg Flakus reports from Houston, the high school girl from Kilgore, Texas, has just released a new CD with backing from some old pros.
Allie Venable plays guitar with a skill that requires a lot of talent and usually many years of practice. But she packed a lot of practice into a few years.
I've been playing since I was about 11 or 12, so roughly 4 or 5 years. So.
She also wrote most of the songs on her recently released CD, No Glass Shoes.
But it's too much too soon.
I try to write what goes on in my life so that other people and other teenagers and anybody can relate to it, because we all go through the same things and we all have troubles and struggles.
When she plays, she gets lost in the music.
I really don't look at anything else when I'm playing. I just get into this zone where you just play and you don't think about anything else. I love to find little kids because I have a wireless, and I'll play for them and I'll let them play my guitar just so they can experience that as a little kid, you know.
Some veteran musicians in Houston have given her help, including musician and recording studio owner Rock Romano, who produced her CD.
I jokingly told her afterward, we need to call this band 1771, because she just turned 17 and I just turned 71. You can just tell that she loves what she's doing and just radiates that from the stage. She's young, and I just can't wait to hear her, you know, 2 or 3 years from now.
As she finishes her senior year of high school, Allie Venable is spending many weekends playing venues as far away as Florida, building an even bigger fan base. Greg Flakus, VOA News, Houston.
That wraps up this edition of today's program, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Charles Hall. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is very concerned over the situation in Ethiopia, particularly the instability in the Oromia and Amhara regions, Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs Linda Thomas-Greenfield said in an interview. Speaking in New York on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly meeting, Assistant Secretary Thomas-Greenfield called the response by the government to protests an intense and somewhat harsh crackdown.
We have had discussions with the Ethiopian government encouraging that they have dialogue and that they open the possibility for press freedom, civil society's ability to function, and that many of the people who have been put in jail.
In Oromia, anti-government protests began in November 2015, and they have also occurred in the northern Amhara region. Assistant Secretary Thomas-Greenfield said the United States believes that the situation in the country could deteriorate and that the Ethiopian government is aware of that possibility as well.
We've met with Prime Minister Haile Mariam here in New York, and we have encouraged him to look at how the government is addressing this situation.
We think, she said, it could get worse if it's not addressed sooner rather than later.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials.
is for